Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatec.
No, you're working at Inatec because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world, and I am a material girl or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
if I had a
Well, and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell. Andrew on the board. SP futures down 65. Ouch. NASDAQ futures down 370. Dow down 572. They're all, S&P's only 0.9%. The rest are over a percent. That's not good. We got oil up 369.74.13. As Trump has declared the ceasefire over. So there you go. Not sure what that's all. I mean, I don't know. I hope it's still posturing back and forth on a way to get this thing over with, but today don't look like it's a uptick, let's put it that way. Do we have Professor Mike and Professor Kevin?
You have, as they say in Chicago, the both of us.
The both of us. Well, that's a good thing. Mike, how are you?
Good morning, Tom. I'm just fine. How are you guys doing?
We're doing all right. We're drying out here after a pretty wet weekend, but the last couple of days
went
have been nice.
Went on a bender, did you?
Oh God! I wish it was that kind of drying up. We got all our July rain in 72 hours, so got kind of a month, rest of the month to go. So, but everything seems to have settled down. One of the guys was working at my place. He's a kayaker, and he said all the action has been done today, so he'll be able to go kayaking. So there you go. So it was a big deal for a while, and a lot of flooding, a lot of you guys know where the Bishop Ford is, and they've got some construction going on there, some long-term construction, and the geniuses that are doing it, I don't know how they pick these construction companies. They must have messed up in their haste to construct, they must have screwed up the drainage somehow. The thing was closed for 3 days with flooding. The whole expressway, or one side of it. I don't think I've ever seen that before. I mean, that's not what you want to have happen, but I think it's back open now. But, Mike, some soccer that's been exciting as hell, and some that kind of boring as hell and controversy. So where do you want to start?
Okay, well, the U.S. loss was a disappointment, but, Belgium was obviously the better team that night. And we have a good match coming up tomorrow. So today's the first day without any matches at all during the World Cup, I think. Thursday is France versus Morocco. That's a replay of actually the quarterfinal, I think, in 2022 in Qatar. So I think France will win that one, but it'll be a tight game. Morocco will try to play that boring block, the defensive game. But France has too much to go up against them. And Morocco has one or two outstanding players, whereas France has probably four or five at least, with Mbappe being the best, but then Dembele, and then they have their playmaker, Elise. He's really good. He sets up both Mbappe and Dembele. And then on Friday, you have Spain and Belgium. That should be a good match. I think Spain will win that one. I personally thought we had a chance against Belgium because I thought they were getting too old, but didn't happen. And Kevin De Bruyne, who's one of the better players on Belgium, didn't even play. And Saturday there's two games, one of which should be fantastic, which is Norway and England. That's the first one. That's at I think 5 o'clock Eastern. And then the second one is Argentina and Switzerland. And Switzerland will try to play that slow defensive-type game, but Argentina, I think, will whip them. And that one's at 9.
Well, so, the France game, I was I thought the guy, the announcer that's on the right, the guy, Mr. Slick back here, looks like I don't know, he looked like a bandito of some kind, but all he did was talk about how great France was, and they could take over this game anytime. Clearly they've got the ball all the time, and I'm sitting there, I don't know what he's watching. Look to me, they didn't do anything. They get a shot on, didn't get a shot on goal to halfway through the second half. Then they got the one penalty kick, and they won, and I'm thinking, I don't know where he was seeing all this dominance. I didn't see any, but anyway, just me. I don't know that much about soccer.
Well, Paraguay played a very defensive game. I think they wanted to get to a shootout and hopefully beat France like they did with Germany, but that didn't happen. So, if the France and Morocco will be a good game, but I think France will win that one. So,
Argentina, it was quite the game yesterday, huh?
Oh my gosh, yeah. The Egyptians, well, they kind of blew that game, actually. I mean, they were up 2-0, and they probably should have been up 3-0. That was kind of a BS call.
Well, explain that one. I heard about it all night, and yet I never saw the replay. What happened?
They said that, one of the Argentina guys was attacking. So he was in the offensive end, and then there was a foul against him, and then Switzerland scored as a result of that foul. Or not Switzerland, but Egypt scored as a result of that foul, and so then they called it back. The ref didn't think it was serious enough, but the video review thought it was serious. So I couldn't believe, and the announcers were kind of stunned by the way they made the call too.
They called a foul on the guy with the ball that scored.
No, they called a foul on the guy, on an Argentina guy that was trying to score. He was attacking, and one of the Egyptians fouled him. I'm not sure which one, but then the Egyptians had a great counterattack. And they ended up scoring. It's funny to me, Egypt had a guy named Zico, and then later in the game they had a guy named Zizo.
Okay.
So it just Mo Salah is the big Egyptian player. This will probably be his last World Cup. He played for years in England, so he's very familiar with the style of play at least a rough style of play, but Argentina is just too good. They were also lucky too, but that's beside the point.
Let me see if I understand this. So what they're saying is the referee did not call a foul.
And that's correct. He let it play on, Kevin. Yes.
He let them play on, and then the replay said, well, you should have called the foul, which would have stopped the play on, and therefore everything that happened after that doesn't count.
That's correct. I think that's why the ruling was the way it was.
Now, how pissed would you be if that were your team?
Oh, my gosh. Well, and the Egyptian coach was very upset, and I think he got at least a yellow card. Most of their staff was kind of on, they weren't quite on the field, but they were in their coaching boxes really going after the ref. They didn't, and it was a French ref, too, so.
Well, and I don't necessarily think it's the ref's problem, other than maybe he should have called the foul in the first place and the whistle would have blown and none of this would have happened.
Right.
But, you know, why would the replay officials at that point intervene?
But every other sport, football, hockey, if there's a penalty and you play on and score a goal or score a touchdown, you decline the penalty.
In hockey, that would be a delayed call, and they would wait until the offending team touched the ball, in hockey, and the offending team touched the puck. But that's obviously not the rules for football here. So,
well, it goes down to how fixed is it? I mean, the replay official, what even possessed him to look at something like that if it didn't even affect the play?
Well, but it did affect the play. To a degree, the Argentinian guy would have had a pass inside, and then maybe Argentina could have scored, but instead Egypt scored on a counterattack.
Okay.
So, it's I've talked about this with some of my neighbors who also follow soccer pretty closely. And, you know, they're so technical when there's a goal scored, but they're not technical on these subjective fouls that are clearly sometimes, you know, kind of a BS call. You know, like Balogun, the granted the president is catching grief, but Balogun should not have been given a red card for what he did. It was not an intentional foul, and it was kind of by accident. So, you know, the fouls on the field are way too subjective. That's my opinion.
Well, when you got one ref and 22 people, it's almost designed to be that way.
Well, but there's actually three refs, and the assistants should be helping, and they do. And then you got the video guys are helping. There's at least two people in the video review, and I think that's headquartered in Dallas.
But a regular soccer game does not have a video review.
Yes, they do now. All the regular soccer games do.
You mean?
Not kids' soccer game, but the pro games all have video review.
Well, I mean, it just seems like, I mean, I'm sure as hell not making policy here, but in football you got 22 people and you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 refs. In soccer you got 22 people and you got one.
Tom, there are three officials on the field, essentially. There's the two on the sidelines, and they are able to make calls to a degree, and then the main ref on the field.
So they can call, because like the linesman in hockey can't call a penalty.
Well, the linesman, the guys on the side can definitely call offsides, which is the most critical call.
Okay.
I think they can also call, although I'm not sure about this, but I'm pretty sure they can call blatant fouls, too.
Okay, I thought they could notify the referee, but he had a call. I don't know.
You might be right about that, but they do definitely notify the referee.
Well, they're definitely not dead.
During the game, sometimes they will get together and talk, too.
Yeah, I'm not saying that they're dead. They're mute. I mean, it's still, the difference between 1 and 6 is kind of a lot. You know.
No, I agree.
I mean, in football, the object is...
The refs keep good control of the game. The French guy, I think he lost control of the game during the Argentina-Egypt game.
Okay. Well, I tell you what, though, has there ever been a last 3 minutes that have been like that? Or did Egypt, I mean, obviously, you know, you and I and Kevin have all played a lot of sports. It seems like what happened is Argentina was just deeper and the other guys ran out of gas with 5 minutes to go. Is that kind of what happened?
It was really with about 15 minutes to go, and that is kind of what happened, because Argentina was in the offensive zone almost that entire last half hour of the game.
God, how did the Brits end up winning that game? Good Lord, they were surrounded.
Well, the Brits, the Bellingham, who I was not very fond of until that game, he scored two great goals. And then Harry Kane scored a penalty. So Bellingham essentially kept them in the game. And, you know, it's also kind of funny. Well, not funny, but tragic to me. Malik Tillman got the U.S. back into the game. And then immediately Belgium scores a goal. And that kind of put the U.S. away. We just didn't have the horsepower to go up against those guys.
Who's the
Pulisic?
What struck me about that, Mike, and you can opine, was that they were just sloppy on their defense in front of the goal.
Oh, they were sloppy all over, Kevin. Their passing was terrible.
Yeah, nobody got led. You know, all the passes were behind the guys that intended to them. So there was a lot to criticize. But what I'm saying is that in front of the goal, how many teams have we seen that bunch up really well in front of the goal and stop people from getting good shots? And, you know, instead, you know, the goals that the U.S. gave up, they were actually getting really clean looks at the goal.
You're right. I mean, and that the kid, the younger guy that had the two goals against us, he was clearly open both times. One time he was set up beautifully, and then the other time was, you know, a cross from the side, and he had a beautiful header. And then, you know, that Freeze blew that one. You know, he essentially gave them a goal.
Yeah.
Mike, who's the guy on the Britain team? I don't think he scored, but he kind of guy looks like a young our friend Dr. Blade, the guy with the blonde hair, and he's kind of slender. He is fast as all get out. He was caught. I don't think he scored, but he was giving them fits. You know what guy I'm talking about? I don't know. I can't remember his name.
Is he a wing or is he?
He was up front. He was kind of, I don't know what he was a forward, whatever the hell that means. But that was a question. That was a question I was going to ask you today, as they say in the South Side. What if somebody is just a really really good? You know, everybody has different physical skills, but if you're just an all around terrific player, where do you put him? Is he a midfielder? Is he a forward? Or I mean,
I would say he's a midfielder because they can go both ways. You know.
Do midfielders score a lot? Are any of them ever?
Some of them do, but they're mostly kind of the playmaker type. They set things up for the strikers and the wings on the side.
Right. So if you're in the middle of the front, you're considered a striker.
Yes, the middle guy, like Harry Kane, is a striker, as is Bellingham. Messi, he's not the classic striker, but he's definitely a striker. I mean, he plays a center forward.
What's the alignment? Is it 5-3-2, or you can do whatever you want?
You can do whatever you want. A lot of them play a 4-4-2, and then the goalie in the back.
It seems like the Brit goalie was... That guy had to go for a massage after the game. How beat up was he?
Oh, yeah, he took a beating. You're right. I mean, but, you know, they pulled it out. And that will be a great game because Norway has that big guy, Haaland, H-A-A-L-A-N-D. He's tremendous in the middle, and he's like Messi. He kind of shows up when he needs to. You know, he'll get a rebound or he'll have a big header. And he's been really good during this tournament, as has Messi, as has Harry Kane, and Bellingham had the two great goals. And, you know, and England was shorthanded for roughly most of the second half. I think it was like 30 minutes. So they pulled that one out. I was really surprised. But I think the weather definitely helped the Brits because... The first half was just, you know, it was wet and sloppy, and that took away some of the Mexican speed, I think.
When those guys, when they actually was pulling for them because they were such underdogs and with the guy off the field, and when they got to the end, as soon as they said 11 extra minutes, I go, no way. No way can they do this for a little. I thought the extra minutes would be like 5, and then it was 11. I'm going, eh.
Right.
I thought for sure they were never going to withstand another 11 minutes, but they did.
They did. They pulled it off somehow. The England Norway game will be very interesting. So we'll see how that one goes.
Well, it seems. I mean, you get an appreciation for these goalies. So for those that haven't watched any of this stuff, and I'm just a total neophyte on this, the goal is so friggin' big. It's not like hockey where you can take a shot from 20 feet and expect the save most of the time. But the goal is so big. But that guy, he went out and he intercepted, God, how many corner kicks and everything else where he just launched himself in the middle of people and grabbed
right.
the ball. I mean, that's got to be dangerous to the body for sure, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Those guys, but, you know, they're obviously in great physical shape, so.
Well, the goalie's the only guy who can grab the ball with his hands, right?
That's correct.
What
The most athletic plays I've seen in this tournament are by the goalkeepers. You know, it is just... You know, some of them, you know, the contortions that they've gone through to deflect a shot have just been awesome.
Well, I had to meet my plumber up at the bar that I met him last night, and I wasn't sitting next to him. I was sitting a guy who's an attorney and whatever, and we're BS. He goes, look at that penalty kick. It looks like the goalie, you know, moved before the guy kicked the ball. And I go, Mike. Look at the size of the goal. If you just stand there, you got to guess on a penalty kick. I mean, how else, you know, I guess you could stand in the middle and hope the guy hits you. But, I mean, if you don't guess, you can't get it either way. Am I right on that?
I don't know about that one, Tom. And they have called a guy, or I think they've had at least one redo during the games where the guy was called for moving ahead of time. And it, on one of the goals in one of those games, it did look like one of them did move.
But well, what I mean is you have to pick a side. The thing is so big, you can't just stand there and react. Nobody can react. If you just stood in the middle, if a ball goes to each side, you're never going to catch it, right?
No. Well, sometimes you end up blocking it. They get lucky.
Yeah. You know. But, I mean, in general, if you don't sort of anticipate where it's going, you got no chance, right?
That's about right.
And they're trying to get a read on the guy making the kick. But, you know, it's so hard. And you see these, you know, you see these guys where they try to show left and then go right, or show right and then go left. It's a guessing game. It's a guessing game between the two of them. That's why when you get to penalty kicks, one stop means the match in many cases.
Well, you see the big, I read something yesterday, well, stuff I'm reading about this, where there's a big outrage worldwide about, or pushback on the stutter step run-up, that evidently people think that was supposed to be the God's gift. We're talking about the guy, they put the ball down in front of the goal, and the guy runs up and kicks it. Well, they used to run up and kick it. Well, now they kind of stutter step up and then maybe stop and hesitate, and then they kick it. And it was supposed to be the revolution of all soccer. Now, evidently, the stat people are saying they're doing worse than they did before, so isn't there a big debate now, Mike, as whether you're supposed to...
Oh, yeah. Carly Lloyd, who is one of the commentators, she was a very good women's player. She was player of the year a couple of years in a row. She's very critical of that stutter step. She just thinks they should just come up and blast away, which I would tend to agree with her, because they were saying, I think it was last night or sometime yesterday, that it was essentially the guys taking the penalty kicks were only making like 3 out of 5. And, you know, sometimes the penalty kick is a nerve thing, too. Like that one guy, I forget what team it was. I mean, he just launched one over the goal.
That was a young kid from Australia.
Well, that might have been, but I forgot about Australia. But it was the games yesterday where he kicked it over the goal. I think it was an Egyptian, but I might be wrong about that. But it's just tragic. Or no, it might have been a Colombian. It was two Colombians missed the goal, and that's why Switzerland ended up winning.
Well, the young kid from Australia, they're saying, oh, man, he's kind of young. They can't believe the kid kicks it over the goal. My question to you is he going to turn into Shooter in Hoosiers?
I have no idea. But there was a guy on England when we were stationed overseas. His name was Gareth Southgate. And he ended up missing a penalty shootout, and England, of course, lost the game, and that was a tragedy for England. And then he ended up coaching the English team, and needless to say, they did very well in penalty kicks after that. After he learned his lesson on that one.
The reference is to the movie Hoosiers with Gene Hackman, and the guy was Dennis Hopper played this guy, and it was. He missed the final shot in their shot at the state championship years ago, and his life, what he ended up being an alkie in town and didn't ever got a job. his whole life was destroyed because he missed the last shot. Wasn't that the story?
Yeah, I think it kind of was, yeah.
Well, I hope that doesn't happen to this kid, but boy. It to me, Mike, it just seems kind of weird. On a bigger stage, you look at... France and Paraguay, and I'm thinking, okay, well, how many people are here from France? How many people are here from Paraguay? Because they don't have any money. And all of a sudden, the game is even except for one penalty, and the other guys win 1-0. You know, for me, you always think that everything could be crooked. I'm just scratching my head. I'm not saying it was or it is, but it seems like without even knowing it, the money keeps moving, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Balogun decision, that was, I would say that was a little bit of corruption. And then the Ronaldo decision, he was supposed to be suspended for the first two games of the World Cup. Well, guess what? Ronaldo brings in a lot of people. So fancy that. They made a decision that he would end up playing. So Yeah.
What did he do to get this, that kind of suspension?
He supposedly punched a guy. I didn't see it, but
in the qualifiers,
the commentator said he did punch the guy. It was a violent incident, is what the way.
In one of the qualifying rounds or in the league play?
No, probably in a qualifying round.
Okay. Well, now who's the chalk here? You still with France and Argentina in the last game?
Yep, it's set up perfectly for that.
Who?
Although England or Norway could sneak in, the Norwegians are tough. You know, we'll see how that goes.
The first game I watched, and I've said this a couple times. The first guy I looked, I go, who's this guy? That big guy, Holland.
I'm like, you're right.
He's as fast and as good as everybody else, and he's 30 pounds of muscle heavier. Where does that?
But he's not as fast though, Tom. They can't. He's got to be set up. Like Messi can kind of set himself up to a degree. You know that Messi does that give and go like it's going out of style. Holland, they've got to cross the ball into him, and Norway has some good tall guys, and they kind of excel at those set pieces, so the corner kicks and the crosses into the middle, and that's where Holland comes into play.
Well, you see some of the defenders are used to like leaning on a guy and shoving him a little bit. He doesn't even move.
No, right. He doesn't move. And that's where Balogun was pretty good, too. Balogun would put his back to some of these players, and then he would power. You know, he would just keep backing up and... And he was successful doing that. His play, it was like a good rebounder in basketball. That's kind of, you know, he kind of guarded the ball very well with his body.
Yeah, or maybe like a good post-up player, Shaquille O'Neal or something. Where,
exactly, you know. Right. And that's the way Holland is, I think, too.
Hey, I got a question for you guys, just kind of off the topic of just about everything, but I've been watching...
Well, what else is new, Tom?
Yeah, I know. Well, I've been... But it has to do with, you know, kind of the press and the world we live in and those kinds of things. I was never a fan of this guy in Maine. It seemed like, well, put it this way. I think a lot of people running for all these, they're not my idea of a Renaissance man. They're not like you, Mike. The army, well-read, actually somewhat balanced. They're not, I don't know where we get these people, but anyway, we do. So the guy's running. John Flanagan talked about his background a couple weeks ago, and he's not a big fan. You know, so I'm really no fan of the guy. But I don't know what exactly you do with a 5, 10, 15-year-old whatever. And I'm guessing from what my read of the guy, it wouldn't surprise me. But what exactly do you do with an allegation lobbed out like that, where there's no trial, there's no evidence, there's no... And then all of a sudden, everybody jumps to the side. If you're, you know, pro women, which I hope all of us are. Oh God, well, she wouldn't have said that if it wasn't true. Yet a lot of people say stuff that isn't true. I don't even know what the rights and the privileges or the defense or what it even lands is. I mean, it's been a long time for us, but what if somebody surfaced from 40 years ago and said, God, I was on a date with this guy, and I didn't really want that last shot, and then we went to his place, and I don't remember what happened, but it seemed to me I had sex. I can't imagine. I said yes. What do you do with that? Nobody else was there. Maybe it's true. Maybe it isn't. I mean, with this guy, maybe I'm believing it is true, but I don't even know what does that mean in our system of, you know, is it a crime? Is it something you can file a complaint for? I don't even know how to define it. I mean, I'm not making any policy here. I'm just totally clueless with what to do with this. I mean, how do you defend it if it's wrong? And the reason why I say this is when Cardinal Bernardine, who was kind of a favorite of mine, he was the Cardinal of Chicago two Cardinals ago. Terrific guy, died young of cancer. Well, he had an allegation from some guy in Philadelphia when he was out there that he was a pedophile. It turns out the guy never even saw him and never even was... But this went on for 3-4 months till finally the dude never even came in contact. He never was even in Philadelphia when Bert... It was a total hunk of BS. Fortunately, it worked its way through the system and he was vindicated, but for a long period of time, if he was running for something, he would have had to quit. I mean, I guess I don't even understand what we're doing here. I mean, and at this level, I'm talking too much. What are we supposed to do?
A couple of things. So, there's a whole bunch of dynamics at work here. So, you know, first of all, it's not his first. It's his first forcible sexual assault one, although there are other claims that have come along throughout the campaign. And that, and I'm going to say the Democrats, but you know it could be anybody. So, but in this case, it is Democrats, and people have stuck with them through one allegation after another until they decided that this is too far. Now, to me, it seems like we're past the primary. I think there was a time when before the primary, because the guy won overwhelmingly in the primary, there was a time leading up to the primary when it would have been terribly inconvenient to abandon him and to have him pull out. So I guess we wait until after the primary, but before the deadline for the party replacing him, for the party being able to choose who they want and replace him. Now, I just like with Swalwell, I don't think there is any chance that his whole history wasn't known, and that people, pent up allegations like this were not known. I just don't believe it. So I think there's a time when they say, "Uh-oh, this isn't going to work for us." So do I think there are people taking a principled position now after sticking with this guy for so long? Maybe. But I also think that there's a whole lot of people that's saying, okay, let's do this now and get it over with so that we actually have a chance to replace this guy. Very much like Swalwell in the governor's race in California, everybody knew what was going on with him. They didn't have anything to say about it the whole time he was in Congress. But when it looked like he was going to screw up the balance of the governor's race in California and put a Republican on the ballot, all of a sudden, oh my God, we can't have this guy. So call me cynical, tough luck.
I don't have a problem with that. I'm just saying, again, you know more about this than I do, and so did Mr. Flanagan. But it seems this is the first time that one lady has come out and said on such and such a date 5 years ago it actually happened, right?
I mean, it is, and so I will then say, yeah, should the guy be entitled to due process on this? Yeah, he should. His problem is we're piling allegation right. on allegation, and not just with women, but there are other issues that he has, like his totem comp.
Like I said, I'm not a fan of the guy, but I guess my question was, and still is, for Bodie, is what exactly is the due process?
Well, it's the court of public opinion, I think, Tom, at this point. And, now it's kind of just like Biden to a degree. And, Kevin used Swalwell, but the Dems, they threw Biden under the bus when it came out or when it looked like he was totally incompetent. And now this guy, there's just too much there for them not to do something. So they don't want to, they're going to end up, I bet you, going with the governor of Maine, that Janet Mills, because, Plattner is, there's just too much baggage with him, which should have been considered in the primary, but obviously it wasn't, because, he was very flamboyant and vocal and they thought they had a chance with him against Collins, and now I think they've made up their minds that he doesn't have a chance against Collins.
Well, so, I'm not a fan, but some people are known womanizers. Take our president, for instance. And I guess my question is, in our system of quote law, you mentioned something, actually, Mike, that you're absolutely right on. But it makes the nerves on the back of my neck go flying up. The court of public opinion. Boy, that's a bad spot.
Well, it's unfortunate, but, that's what happens, Swalwell should have been in jail years ago because of, you know, his dalliance with the Chinese spy. Well, that didn't happen. And, you know, it's really gotten unfortunate that the state of our politics is so bad that we can't have balanced people in the Congress who are actually working for the American people. Sometimes I don't think they are working for the American people. They're working for themselves to build up their reserves.
And we
know Schumer won't come out against anything. Mitch McConnell didn't come out against much. You know, Mitch McConnell had to have a stroke on the floor for him to give up the Speaker of the Senate, or the whatever that title is.
Majority leader.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, though, that's I can't even go down this road. I agree with Kevin. That's what I don't want to. Because of his history that's been given to me by Kevin and Jan, I'm inclined to believe this lady. Okay, but that's dangerous too. I don't know anything about it. Why would I believe one or the other? I don't know either one of these people.
Well, they discounted the first woman because she was a Republican operative. But, you know, now there's been other, you know, dalliances come out. And, you know, the guy's just, as you said, a womanizer. So, yep. But then there's other things that he's done. You know, he badmouthed fellow soldiers.
He's not badmouthed
people you've been in combat with. Come on.
Like I said, Mike, he's not our idea of a Renaissance man.
No, not at all.
But it's the buildup. So in politics, you know, all of this does get weighed. So, you know, whether it's Nazi tattoo, whether it's Reddit posts saying women should take some responsibility for sexual assaults because they, you know, they probably could have stopped them or should have said, you know, or let people on, that he's posting on a website that is known to be populated by pedophiles, that he has multiple allegations of abuse, that all of this is coming out. And I don't understand why they stuck with him so long. You know, this could have been dealt with 3 or 4 months ago, and with a chance to recover.
Okay, how?
Rather than now.
How?
Well, they could have gone with Mills, Tom. Instead, they went with someone that they thought had a chance with the working people of Maine. But so they made a deliberate decision, and then now that deliberate decision is backfired.
Okay, but remember, walk through the process here, right? I decide to run for whatever, Republican or Democratic congressperson. I get my signatures, I get in there and I run, and I win. If I'm a sleazebag, when does the party tell me I got to stop running and I got to get my name off the thing? They even help me out at all.
Apparently this week.
Well, okay. But he still has to get out by himself.
He hasn't withdrawn yet.
But I'm saying what... When does the party get to tell anybody who's running you got to quit?
Unless he withdraws, he's the candidate.
I know that. What I'm saying is, when Mike mentioned that they should have gotten rid of him, I'm not so sure they could have. Could they?
No, they couldn't have, because he was obviously he was winning in the court of public opinion, and he beat Mills. You know, Mills pulled out of the race, so he didn't have much competition in the final result.
Why did she pull out? Didn't have any money or what?
I'm not sure.
Well, she didn't pull out. She suspended her campaign.
Well, they all suspend their campaign. Yeah. That way I think they can keep their money.
Well, it also means if the other two people get run over by a car, they can get back in.
Right.
Get back in. So, yeah, but how do you do it? You know, how much have we seen how this works? Once a party picks its candidate, for example, Joe Biden versus Bernie Sanders. Sanders was leading, and then all of a sudden, come the South Carolina primary, people started dropping out of the race and throwing their support to Biden because the party was petrified that Sanders couldn't possibly beat Trump. As an avowed socialist. Now it's more acceptable to them, but at the time it was completely unacceptable. They were afraid Sanders was going to get the nomination, so the whole party rallied to supporting Biden. That's you know, that's really typical, and that happens in all kinds of local races as well as national races, and it happens with Republicans as well as Democrats, that once the party decides on a candidate, it is really hard for somebody to beat that candidate.
The greatest example of that probably was when McCain beat Bush in both Iowa and New Hampshire, and they ran the incredible negative campaign against McCain in Carolina. The party,
you know, I think you see it all the time, is who's the chosen one, you know, who, to an extent, whose turn is it, you know, you and I'll give you another example. In the in the last go around, RFK Jr. was running, and all of a sudden, man, the way the Democrats went after him, they were pushing him off ballots. They, you know, they were doing all kinds of things, not because they thought he would win, but he was pulling, you know, he was starting to pull support, you know, pull in some support, and we just couldn't have this. So,
well, remember, who's the guy with the big ears that ran when Bush lost? Tell us his name. The guy who ordered his house in the Bermuda.
Ross Perot.
I got a question since Mike brought it up. And by the way, Mike isn't just our soccer guy. Mike actually had to go with economics classes to me at Notre Dame, so I know he knows some economics. And Kevin, of course, does since he teaches it. When you
actually, I teach econ, I teach management.
But it's close enough. It's close enough. You got to know how to add and subtract. It's close enough.
Right. I have no intention of teaching either macro or microeconomics.
Oh, if you did, I'd come in your class and like critique. I'd come to your class and critique like you do me. Anyway, Mike, when you mentioned the people in Congress working for them, I think somewhere along the line we need to reassess what exactly it means to be in Congress. And please don't say we don't want to up their salary because we know they're stealing, because that's why they're stealing. Somewhere along the line we have to define these jobs as being jobs that are like for real, because the money that's swirling, and the three of us, as much as we talk about it or think we know, the money that's swirling that I try and talk about, but even I can't get my hands on the numbers of it, is so different, it's so bizarre that I mean, I'll just use a current example. The Trump kids that just bought into this the drone manufacturer and got this bid, or they got this big contract for drones. They're going to make more money than everybody in the Senate and the representatives combined in the next 5 years. If we keep going up with this drone stuff, which I think we do, and I understand this, actually the place they bought into makes pretty good drones. So, but yesterday I was talking on the show, and under down again, another $39. So Micron is down. We're talking $350 in a week. They've got 1.1 billion shares outstanding. That's that's pushing $400 billion, which is more money in a week than the biggest stock was valued in 2010. I don't think anybody normal, which I consider the three of us, or the listeners, have any idea of the amount of money that's swirling. And I think when these guys get to Washington, and we've talked, you know, Kevin certainly has been on a lot of these shows, we've talked about the people get to Congress, and I really do believe, because I met a lot of these guys when I was on the board of the SIBO, of course, things might have changed, and especially the small towns, most of them are pretty much real people that have run and they get there, and, you know, Carl had a buddy who did, won a couple of terms as a Republican in Florida. All of a sudden, the pressure to be co-opted, the amount of money is so dramatic, it's almost like, hey, Dad, if you're not getting a piece of it, what's the matter with you? I mean, we've kind of reached that stage where it's so enticing, it's so big. I mean, when you see, you know, Elon Musk making $1 trillion because of two or three sweetheart deals with the government, do you think the people in government don't go, wait a minute, I'm making $80,000 a year to give this guy $1 trillion? What am I doing here? I mean, it's becoming, I agree with you totally, Mike, but somehow or another, the cesspool we've created doesn't allow anybody to just be a Renaissance man. You can't have a Paul Simon anymore. You can't have an Adlai Stevenson. You can't have a Chuck Percy or any of those kind of Everett Dirksen. You can't have it doesn't appear that when you're handing out stuff to people, it's worth, you know, $2 billion a pop, and you're making $150 grand a year, that you don't somehow along the line say, what the hell am I doing? I mean, I'm not giving a solution here. I'm just saying that this has gotten so huge that you're and I and Kevin's idea of a public servant, unless you're a candidate that has money and that you don't need it, or Trump, I guess, does, but he still wants to make more. But if you, unless you have dough like that, or Roosevelt that had Hyde Park and everything, I don't know. I'm just rolling on here, but it seems to me that something, so much stuff has changed that our view of a public servant, boy, I don't know.
Go ahead, Mike.
I've talked about this with Blade, and I've probably talked about it with you, Tom. I think term limits is the solution, and we just need a president for a 6-year term like the Germans do, and that's it, one term. That way you get away from this endless campaigning. We had a good congressman, Mike Gallagher, whose father was actually in our class, and at our, I think it was our 50th reunion, the father said that Mike Gallagher pulled out of Congress because he couldn't do any good because he was continually campaigning. So, you know, there's something wrong with our system that, and I hope that term limits might make it more palatable, you know, and we could throw around different times, but the president, that's the most important position, and I think that ought to just be 1 6-year term and be done with it.
I'm going to, for a lot of reasons, part of them is the way the guys used to think on the trading floor, I'm going to say that the term limits are a zero solution, and for a couple of reasons. Not because I'm intellectually opposed to it, Mike. I sort of agree with you intellectually. The workaround, if I'm Merck and I want to pay people off for drugs, all I do is drop down a level. And I actually read some article a couple of years ago about how people, like even running that are in like the state legislatures in the various states, that they think might have a future. You know, a 26-year-old Mike Murphy that's already showing that he can carry a committee in Illinois or Iowa, wherever the hell it is, they're already giving you dough with the idea that you might get there someday. And I don't. Plus, if you decide to do it, it's a 4-year fight to do it, and then probably people are grandfathered in. So even if it is a solution, it's not a solution for 2 decades. So we can't sit around and wait for that to help. I'm saying. I mean, even if I agree with you conceptually, the process leads me to believe even if we could pull it off, by the time we get there, not only we're dead, our kids are dead, for God's sake. You know, and so I mean, it's not this pie-in-the-sky solution. I mean, I was listening to a Democrat and Republican the other night, and both of them sounded like they didn't know what the hell they were talking about. Democrat said something kind of dumb, and then the Republican guy said, well, the solution is for people to elect better people. And I'm going, okay, I guess that's a solution, but how exactly do we put that one in motion?
because people get slimier as they work their way up the political ladder. I would ask a different question, Tom, because I think this gets into it a little bit, and is part of the problem. Is at what point can you tell a politician's spouse that he or she can't operate in their own world and be successful?
Or son, so, or brother-in-law?
And I was going to go back and say, yeah. At what point, where do you draw the line for in-laws, for offspring, for all of those? Where do you draw the lines on those? Because let's just say in the purest sense, are they entitled to make a living however they see fit? Does anybody have a problem with? I don't know. I'm trying to think of a situation where somebody is off, you know, and making a living, and it has nothing to do with politics. So you're not going to restrict that. But you know, at what point do you say, sorry, your father, your mother, your husband, your wife is in elected office, therefore you have to suspend whatever you're doing with your career? And I think that's that. At one point, you look at that and say, "Well, duh, yeah, of course." And at the other hand, you say, "Well, is that really fair? And is that reasonable?" And I don't know. And then how can you engineer separations from politics so that you can continue to pursue it? And you know, I'll give you a good example. Let's go back to Hunter Biden. If Hunter Biden wants to go to work for Burisma on their board and do work for them and they pay him, I got no problem with that. If Hunter Biden wants to go work for Burisma because, as a quid pro quo for his father getting a prosecutor fired and then half of his earnings go back to Pops in the forms of Hunter has to pay all his bills because he's getting largesse, well, that's corrupt. So, you know, the same thing, whether, you know, is somebody getting a heads up on drone investments or getting a contract steered their way because of the family relationship or whatever, that's, you know, Kevin, that's all a form of corruption. So now we're looking at this and going, okay, how do we engineer this so that you have the right kind of safeguards in place? And I don't think that's an easy answer.
But what you're saying, and I'll try and summarize, because by the way, Andrew, you got to destroy this tape. This is twice now I've agreed with Kevin. If you remember the book where Ryan became president in one of Tom Clancy's novels, he ended up becoming president, and his wife was an eye surgeon at Johns Hopkins. So every morning, helicopter picked her up and flew her over to Johns Hopkins, and she did eye surgery all day. I don't think anybody would think that she should stop being an eye surgeon. I think what we're searching for in the air here, and Mike could be the referee. Now, Wendi Graham, on the other hand, was on the board of Enron, and she allegedly engineered the carve out where Enron was not subject to regulation because they weren't considered future contracts; they were all spot contracts. Now, I would have been diametrically opposed to that. Okay. But she was on the board. And, oh, by the way, she was the head of what committee is governance, where you're supposed to be in charge of spanking the place if you have to? She was the head of the governance committee. Now, I'm going to say she got the job because Graham was the big shot in the Senate, and that's the only reason why she got it, and she was able to use her influence. Now, if she was somebody who's happened to be an attorney somewhere else and they met 15 years ago and she was on the board of God knows where, all on her own before they got married, and I know they probably are happy that now she's the president's wife, but that's not why she got the job. I'm going to say I'm probably okay with that. But, oh boy, we're starting to really split hairs here. I mean, I think
we are. Let me give you a more benign one. Suppose Melania Trump wants to work as a model. She's an older woman, and she's absolutely beautiful, and there's a whole world of fashion for older women where she would be fantastic. Now, some people would hire her because she's the first lady. Some people would hire her just because she's a really good model. And I don't know how you tell the difference on that. But should she be curtailed just because she's married to the president?
I'm going
to
say if all of a sudden the place starts getting some favoritism. By the way, how many older people look like that? How good would she be as a model?
She'd be fantastic. She is fantastic.
I know. As I'm saying, she looks too good for most people her age. I mean, how many people her age are going to buy the stuff she can wear? You and I could be models for old guys because we look like old guys.
Yeah, well.
We'd be like Rodney Danger. Was it Stout and something something was the name of his store? Big and Stout?
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you what, though. People always tell me they're surprised when they learn my age. So, you know, you look like an old guy.
No, I don't. But, you know, but I don't look 40.
You look like an old guy when you were 20.
Well, it's...
So, at any rate, but, you know, so now let's take that out of the White House and say, what if she were a senator's wife?
Well, Wendi Graham was one, and McConnell's wife.
But now let's just say senator's wife is a model, and working.
Like I say, if it's
senator's wife is, you know, a good trader.
I'm not so sure I could. I'd want the wife trading. I mean, and assuming that, you know, in the midst of the night, he never mentions any company whatsoever.
What if somebody on your payroll has a a spouse who was elected to the Senate, and this person has been a really great employee for 10, 15 years, you know, whatever it is, and now are we going to say that that person is not eligible to keep working?
If he's in the back office, if he's doing some stuff with people with stock where we're doing some stuff, if he starts walking in with a stock tip of the day from the wife, then I think I got a problem.
Yeah, but what if we don't get the stock tip of
well,
the day?
Well, then if he's working the back office.
Hey, Chief, you know, you're totally on the model thing because, you know, Jill Biden was on the cover of Vogue three times when Biden was president.
Yeah, well.
That wasn't due to her looks.
All right, so if your wife became governor, would that put you on the cover of People as a model?
Dude, nobody gives I had to catch myself there. Nobody cares about me doing anything.
There's a fine hello on a Tuesday or Wednesday morning.
I'm self-aware enough to know that the two people that care about me are the two dogs that are sitting with me on the couch right now.
Well, how much did what's her name? McConnell's wife, the Asian girl lady.
Elaine Chao.
Yeah, what
Elaine Chao. Yeah.
How much did she benefit Wells Fargo when they were guilty of
everything?
Yeah, guilty of everything possible.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a lot. You know, anybody that I think there's a whole cottage group of people like that, and the Clintons are kind of like that as well. Where she, you know, got to coattail along with her husband a bit, and then became somewhat successful as well.
Well, as Secretary of State, a whole lot of money went into their foundation. From people who got treatment, and you can say, well, it was foundation money, not directly into the pockets. But I'm telling you, anybody involved with the foundation lived pretty darn well, going to all these conferences and things that they had, you know, for staying.
Well, I can also tell you that the Russell Rhodes Foundation, if you guys give me some money, I promise it won't go to my daughter's weddings.
Yeah, well, the only donations I'm expecting are from my future nursing home. So,
okay,
but you know, I think what we're if I could, Russell, you are the economist. I think for any of the society, when you start doing that, it's always a dumb thing. For society to try and fix the problem, if there needs to be, well, I think there needs to be a fix of some kind. I think we have to understand, we collectively have to understand how much money is involved. That we're talking about the mayor of Chicago making, you know, whatever, how much a year, or even an alderman, if he gives an okay to a zoning variance, the dude with the zoning variance might make $20 million that nobody else could possibly have made. The numbers are so huge, and you got to be careful because people are trading for you all the time. You got to be careful that you don't say, "Well, I think the senator is making $250 a year. That seems pretty damn good to me. That guy should be purer than Pharaoh's wife." That guy is tossing around literally billions of dollars a week to people. That they would be happy. I mean, how many people tonight, if you went to the coffee shop or the bar and said, "Boy, isn't it something that it costs $1 billion to run for president?" People go, "Man, that really sucks." There have to be 250 companies or people in this country who would be happy to finance the entire $1 billion. I mean, people have lost track of how much money is out there, and I think that's part of the collective idiocy, for lack of or lack of knowledge. I mean, am I totally wrong here? Does anybody know? Go ahead.
Was it Kerry that made that funny comment when they said, you know, we're talking a billion here, a billion there, and now we're talking about real money?
That was Dirksen.
Was it Dirksen?
Yeah, like 50 years ago.
I thought that was John Kerry. Yeah. Maybe just because he made so many stupid comments in his life, I just automatically think he's the guy. He's my default Jeopardy answer if there's ever a stupid final answer question.
What do you mean? He was Skull and Bones.
I don't. The guy's a doddering fool.
My mother.
Just look at. I mean, he's a grifter, and he's the worst. I mean, where did his money come from?
My mother, when he was running against Bush, said, "How is it with 300 million people? We got two guys with C averages that both sat in a coffin looking up at dead animals."
My favorite Kerry story is the Stones were playing Foxborough, and they blocked everybody from getting in, so that he and Teresa could get through the gate real quick or take their time, I'm sure. And somebody goes, "Why don't you just hurry up?" And there was more colorful language there. And Carrie said, "Sir, you don't know. Apparently, you don't know who I am, sir." And he goes, "I know who you are, you grifter." Blah blah. I'm just trying to get in there. I want to go to the concert.
Well, anytime you try and make yourself better than other people, it's not going to go too well.
Yeah, and he's one of those guys that just comes across as he automatically thinks he's better than everybody else in the room.
Now, if it was me, I'd say, "Give me a baseball hat. Let me in the back gate. Let's not bother anybody else."
That's right. And I still use my fake mustache to get around.
Oh, God. You don't have the big sideburns, too, do you, the Elvis thing?
No, I put those away in the late 80s.
But, I mean, these issues, I mean, they're trying to, I feel like I'm in George Stigler's class, because we used to talk about this 40 years ago, for God's sake. The same thing. How do you incentivize people? I mean, somebody asked him a question one day, and I remember to this day. He said, what about Chicago politics? Why is it crooked? He goes, "Well, you got a bunch of people that you can't pay the alderman very much because he's stealing. But then again, if he's stealing, you're pissed at him." He goes, "Pay the guy a reasonable number, then expect him not to steal. If you want, pay him a big number, put it all in escrow, and if he gets charged over the next year, 10 years, he forfeits his escrow. I can fix this tomorrow." But nobody wants to do that. I mean, how does a president not make $10 million a year, for God's sake? Why should he make less than a left fielder? Of course, as Babe Ruth said, "I had a better year than you," right?
Actually, he's currently working for free as far as the payroll goes, but...
Yeah, he doesn't take his salary.
Okay, but
he donates it somewhere. It's really wonderful how he donates it, and it's not newsworthy enough that we don't know where it went. But he does do that.
But it's $450 or something. I think
is that how much it is now? I thought it was $4.
I think it's whatever. It's say it's $450. The Secret Service tab to his resorts last year was $65 million for people staying at Mar-a-Lago and those kinds of places. Mm-hmm. Well, that's better than $450, isn't it?
Oh yeah, no, that's most definitely better than $450.
So I mean, who else didn't? Did somebody else not take their salary? Kevin, I don't think so. I thought somebody didn't.
The only other one I remember is Trump the first time.
Yeah. Was this is going to be kind of a funny stretch, but did George Washington do it and not get paid?
Oh, don't lead me down that road. Somebody did a fact check on Trump's speech the other night where he starts talking about Washington having two desks when he did his own business. This is his response to him making all his money. He had his own. First of all, there's no evidence anywhere that Washington had a separate desk for his own crap. And the other thing was he started talking about the Panama Canal and how 38,000 Americans lost their lives there. You know what the number really is? It's like 350.
Yeah, I thought a lot of French lost their lives there.
Oh, a shitload of French. But a lot of the people who lost their lives, like 5,000, were people we imported from Jamaica to do the work. So now all of a sudden the Jamaicans are Americans. They think the total number of people lost after the French left and we took over is like 5,000. But as for people who actually came from the U.S., they think the number is like 350 to 500 or something. But it's a long way from 38,000. Just saying. Now the French lost. God, how many did they lose? They lost. Didn't they lose all theirs to malaria, Kevin? Most of them? I mean, they weren't construction accidents, were they?
No idea. I have no idea about the history of the Panama Canal.
They got stuck in the mud. Really what happened.
I do remember a little bit.
But malaria made it very difficult. They weren't prepared for the environment when they went down there and tried to dig that ditch.
Didn't we, when we went down there, were smart enough to spend the first like 2 years draining swamps and doing stuff and getting rid of as many mosquitoes as we could before we started? I think we did that. We had a little more intelligence on it than the French,
but then again, we learned from their mistakes.
But we can't play soccer like the French can, though. Doesn't appear.
That's okay.
But we got this big sell-off going today. Although we've come back halfway, we're only.
By the way, I'm
going
to ditch you guys now. So right. You guys,
we'll see
Kevin, we'll see you Friday. We've missed you on two Fridays, bud. Mike, thank you. As usual, a great report. Mike still says France and Argentina. Well, I might have to go with that. Do I have to join, like, DraftKings? What do you got to do to join DraftKings, anyway? I have no idea.
Sign up.
What do you get? You got any credit card numbers or something? I don't want to do that.
I don't know. I don't do that. I don't bet on if I bet on any of those things, I use my little Kalshi account, but I don't even bet on those things very much.
Do the Chicago casinos have sports books, or you got to go to Indiana? I don't even know. I haven't been to one.
I know they've got one at the Rivers, just because I get ads for it every once in a while. And you know that because I think to bet sports online, you have to, and you're supposed to be affiliated with a casino somehow here. In Illinois.
Really? I didn't know. I thought they were separate.
I have no idea. I don't. It's something I don't explore because I don't want to start flinging money around like that.
Well, you know, it's talking about a Luddite. I'm not above putting a bet down on the Bears or Notre Dame, but if I'm in Vegas, which I haven't been in a long time, or, you know, I guess I was in Indiana, I want to go give the guy my $50. And then if I win, I go back and get my 105, or maybe give him $55, go back and get my 105. I don't want
that's
it.
That's part of the fun experience is taking the ticket and going, here, give me my money.
I don't want it on my credit card. I don't want anybody telling anybody I made it. Why is it anybody's business?
It's not. And that's why you still have the alternative to do it that other way.
Yeah, provided I fly to Vegas.
Yeah. Well, no, you can probably go down the street. I don't know if the Bally's downtown.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking. I don't know if they do.
I really don't know.
Hey, shifting subjects a little bit, because Carl has been talking a lot. And boy, yesterday we had Carl and Hal on at the same time, which is always a trip. They both are so bright, and yet they love to talk on totally different levels of the chessboard. Same subject, but come at it from like totally different directions, kind of thing, which is great. I mean, it makes my job challenging and also very satisfying because, God, where do you get that kind of knowledge pouring in? You just got to kind of funnel it a little bit. You know, Kyle's been talking for a while, and by the way, you and I have as well, that somewhere along the line, the things that are happening with the deficits and the, you know, and like somebody says, the only time Republicans care about how much money's being spent is when the Democrats are in power. You know, we got the war thing opening up again today. We're bombing people, and the straits back closed again. You know, total bleep show, and hopefully that only is, you know, temporary. But these rates are creeping again. The 30-year is over 5. It's 5.05. And the 10-year is over 4.5, 4.53. So the idea of mortgage rates going down anytime soon, it's just not happening. We're not going to see the Fed cutting anything because inflation is like to the moon. Or it appears to me that it's going to be. Money supply is expanding. What is it finally time when people are going to look at this and say, I'm not lending anybody money for 10 years at 4.5%. I'm stopped being an idiot. Or are we going to see a pop-up in these rates? I look at the reason why I'm so anxious to have you on today. The Japanese were over 162 on the yen here. So those guys are trying to do some intervention. I suspect they're selling U.S. government bonds to get the money to do that. Now they have like almost $1 trillion they've invested here. You know, it's going to be a pimple on the ass of an elephant. It's not the whole trillion or anything like that. Are we starting, you know, Carl's convinced we're starting to get moved toward the break point. We've been saying that, you and he and for quite a while.
That's the part is, I think when you really, when you start to see, you know, the 10-year yields solidly at the high end of the recent range, and I can't remember what the number is off the top of my head.
I will find it for you.
When you start to see that, you start to see it hover there, and it starts to creep above there. That I think that's like a little bit of a canary in the coal mine.
We had a spike at 4.65 on 5.18, and we're not. So, I mean, I think it would
we've been waffling back and forth, but we do, you know, I feel like we're going to start to tick above those levels, and it'll happen slowly at first, but it will be an indication that we're reaching a breaking point, and we're not able to absorb the selling that's going on around the world where people are trying to take care of their own economies right now. And that's the breaking point part of all of this probably goes back to the Iran war, because we've been able to weather, you know, the implications of what went on, what we did in Iran. You know, gas prices went up, they've come back down. There've been some hits to the economy, but you haven't seen, you know, anything that consumers are completely up in arms about. I know we had higher gas prices for a period of time there. The impact on other economies is much more dramatic, and if they start to get into a bit of trouble, that's going to ripple back to us. And I think that might be, you know, how this thing plays out, and how we have some sort of reset or correction in the next year or two.
Well, on a personal level, I think most people know that I'm no fan of the current president corruption, but. But on actually a more serious level, me, I'll say not liking what's going on, is I honestly feel that the man has zero knowledge of actual the economic stuff that you and I talk about, and he goes over to Europe and he says, well, by the way, if you guys don't give us Greenland, I'm going to pull all the troops out. Does he have any
idea? Did he say that again?
Yeah, that's the first thing he said over there, according to one of the things I read.
Oh, gee willikers.
And so now my question is, these people between them, I'll get the page up here. Don't the European nations, don't we owe them like $2 trillion? I mean, what do you
do? They own a whole bunch of our bonds.
Yeah, I mean,
it's kind of like an intertwined situation here,
which I think these guys don't quite get, or if they do, they
yeah.
I mean,
what I'm thinking about with respect to, you know, they lend us money because that's what's happening when they buy our bonds, and you know, at the same time, we provide them security.
Well,
you know, and when we start talking about pulling the security back, well, maybe they should say, well, we're going to stop lending you money.
That, you know, that's what I'm there is a, and I don't know if you and I would have designed this, okay? Mm-hmm. I mean, we probably wouldn't have, but the world economy for a real long time has been, and I really don't think that I can't accuse these guys of not knowing this, because some of these people went to pretty damn high schools. There's a big difference between the trade deficit and the current account deficit. And they don't... If all of a sudden, you know, we're importing Chevys from Mexico and we got this trade deficit, it sounds like a big deal if you point your finger at people and you make it a big deal. You know, the president, you know, mm-hmm. boo-ha-ha. But, in fact, if the people here own the factory down there and the money comes back here in dividends or something... You're even though the trade.
Yeah.
I don't think I don't think you and I would have designed it this way, but the way the thing has been for the world has worked for a while, is the U.S. has imported all this stuff cheaper from other people, kind of screwing our own people here in some ways, in a lot of ways maybe. And the flip side is the money we poured over there, people came back over here and invested in our treasury bonds and essentially. Financed our deficit.
Yeah,
it's not something that you and I would have necessarily said was a good idea. I would hope we wouldn't have.
No,
but the fact is, that's what we've done. And so, if you get some guy who is an economic, in my mind, buffoon, it says, "Okay, I'm gonna." The problem is the trade deficit. Wait a minute. What about all the rest of the stuff? I mean, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not the balance you and I would have created. But it is a balance of some sort, and you got to be careful. You can't just do one thing.
Right.
I mean, all right, I got Japan. This is December 2025. Japan, $1.18 trillion. United Kingdom, $866 trillion. They're up to nine something. Mainland China, $683 trillion. But then you got Belgium, $477 trillion. Canada, who we can't wait to piss off. They're $500 billion. Luxembourg, $435 trillion. France, $368 trillion. Ireland, $340 trillion. I mean, it's not. What did I just rattle off? Like almost $2 trillion just in Europe.
Yeah.
I mean, do we just?
I like how you included Canada in Europe. Because Canada's thinking about joining the EU.
Yeah, what are we doing? You know, Japan actually had more here. They had $1.3 trillion in December of 2021. China is the guys that are up from them are. Mainland China is actually about even to 2021. Belgium's up $100-some billion, and plus they just kicked their ass in soccer.
Why does Belgium have? Where did they get all their money from?
I wonder if this is foreign investments in Belgian banks. It could be, Russell. It's probably more of a Russell question.
That's kind of an unusual one.
Well, Luxembourg is 327. No, I can't believe that's is that the Luxembourg?
I know what people are doing when they go through Luxembourg. I hadn't heard the same thing with respect to Belgium.
Well, Canada,
where you're masking stuff is it? You know, the country is Cyprus still on that list somewhere? Because
I only have the top 10 here, but
okay, yeah, because Cyprus used to be a place that all the Russian oligarchs would hide their money. So you know, all of a sudden you've got a little bitty island in the Mediterranean that's got billions of dollars in the banks.
Well, I'm thinking a lot of the Ireland part must be people over there. I mean, but the people that have moved up, the guy can't stop saying bad shit about the United Kingdom. They're up $200 billion in the last four years.
They're the one country that continues to buy our bonds.
Yeah. I mean, how much? Yeah. Belgium, same way. They were up from 271 to 477. I mean,
the ECB is in Belgium.
Okay,
that might have something to do with
Luxembourg's up $100 billion. These guys have essentially eaten up the drop in China and Japan. So
we appreciate that. Maybe we should protect them so they can keep lending us money.
Well, I don't know that. First of all,
I don't have a problem with the mutually beneficial type stuff. We've got a great relationship. We'll protect them if things go. You know, if the big mean Russian bear tries to lumber over and fight with one of them, we promise we'll come to their aid, and they can fund our goofy lifestyle that they found so interesting as they all came over here for the World Cup.
Well, you know, it's sort of bizarre. I mean, I go back to when the hell was I taking history in high school? A long time ago. Plus, my uncles, one of them served over there and so forth.
You were taking history in high school when my kids were learning about some of the things that were happening.
I was taking history in high school long before your kids were around.
I know.
It's the anyway, but the idea, for Trump to get on his big bazoo and say these guys aren't paying their fair share in NATO. First of all, how many people, if you went through MAGA world and ask them, they would say, because of the way he says it, and people believe somebody who never speaks the truth ever, they would say that somehow or another, they owe us money. First of all, they don't owe us any money. The NATO charter has to do with how much a percentage of your GDP...
They're not contributing their fair share to the... They're not putting what they're supposed to in their defense budget as a requirement to be a member of NATO.
But for their defense budget.
Yeah.
They never...
But it's not like just because they're supposed to do 3% of GDP and they do 2%, that we made up that difference.
Okay,
it's just that they're not maintaining what they're supposed to maintain.
But now if you fast-ass backwards to when I was in high school, say, and if all of a sudden Germany were to say, "Oh, by the way, we're gonna put 10% of our money into into tanks and planes," we didn't want that. We wanted Okinawa. We wanted to control the Far East. We didn't want Japan to rearm and say we'll take care of it.
Yeah.
And so now all of a sudden, we don't want it anymore. It's too expensive. Well, I understand that times have changed, and maybe everybody should be doing the same 5%. I don't have a problem with that. And by the way, I think Obama and Biden both mentioned that to people over there.
I think it's something that's been that we haven't pressed on, but has been coming up for a while.
But the way it's been being done, the fact is, we wanted to have bases in Germany because we wanted to control Europe. We wanted to have bases in Okinawa. We didn't do it because the Japanese refused to come up with a tank. We didn't want them to come up with a tank. Now all of a sudden, we want, and I understand he's right. Now times have changed. Guess what? We're not living on top of the world here anymore. So everybody better do their fair share. I absolutely get that part, but this constant threat and lie and everything else. I mean, do we Do we really want Germany to have the same army they had in 1941?
No, I don't think so. That was what my response was going to be was, you know, Germany, we're, I think everybody's very aware that, you know, Germany, you know, we had World War One. They tried to fight the world twice.
Yeah.
That's what they did. But Norm Macdonald has this whole thing about Germany. He's like, you know, it's kind of crazy, but they tried to, they started two wars and they tried to fight everybody. But, you know, so we're familiar with that. So, you know what? Us having a gigantic base in the middle of Germany and working with them on that, and it's a way to assure that they don't try to fight the world a third time.
Yeah, and maybe enough time has gone by that we don't have to worry about that so much.
Well,
but
Japan, oh my God.
Yeah, yeah.
Japan was basically at war from the 1880s on a continuous basis until the end of World War II. I mean, they were fighting Russia. They were fighting China. They were always fighting everybody. So, I would rather have one of our bases over there and, you know, have it cost us treasure, we'll call the treasure, but not too much blood, but treasure every year. And, you know, for the world order to fall into the way that it has. And us having bases in Japan and Germany has really resulted in, you know, a very nice, peaceful world for maybe almost a couple of generations.
The term is Pax Romana.
Yeah.
Pax Romana was Rome, basically put the world in, and now it's Pax Americana. I mean, do we really want in the next 2 years Japan to build 6 nuclear-powered aircraft carriers? I don't think so.
As long as they're our friends, I got no problem with
that.
Well,
I mean, okay. Okay.
I really, no, and I do feel like that we're so, we're so intertwined with them that, you know, that I don't think they're going to turn those things and start sailing east toward the west coast of the United States one day. I don't see that happening.
Well, you think Denmark never dreamed they needed a submarine or an aircraft carrier to defend Greenland. Now they're not so sure.
We're not going to invade Greenland.
We weren't going to buy Iran
didn't
either.
We have a base on Greenland forever.
We have
that they didn't even know about.
No. We actually have an agreement.
I feel like we went beyond the agreement for a while.
No. We had all kinds of bases over there because that was the weather port to Europe. And we abandoned our bases. And Denmark's response to this is, if you want another base, just tell us. The treaty basically says that we can have as many bases there as we want. We don't have to own it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're down to like one or two, I think. But we still have a big presence there.
I feel like there was a while that we had some secret nuclear stuff going on.
Oh, maybe. Maybe.
Well, and that was outside. Like, maybe we had nuclear weapons at a base in Greenland, and Greenland had said, we don't want those here. Or Denmark said, we don't want those here. So I feel like we overstepped our bounds at some point historically with them.
Well, if we had a B-52
bases there.
If we had a B-52 base there. Wasn't there a time when there was always a B-52 in the air with a nuclear bomb on it or something back in the 50s and 60s?
Yeah, I think there were constant patrols.
Yeah, I think there
just in case. Yeah.
All right, yesterday. By the way, where's our girl? Where's Larissa?
She's traveling this week. Okay. She's got some stuff going on.
See, the problem with Larissa not being here is she opens up the conversation, and we talk about what she says for 2 weeks, and she's one of the biggest droppers of pearls of wisdom that we stick with than anybody on the show. Because she comes at it from a total different area. Because I wanted to ask her today. I've been on kind of a little bit of a theme this week about the, you know, people talk about inflation, and I'm going to start putting a squirt gun in my pocket. And every time somebody says the price of gas or the price of chicken, I'm going to squirt them. Because that's not even beyond. I was listening to this yesterday morning. I don't know if you were listening. I'm driving in, minding my own business, and the guy's talking about remodeling the Uptown Theater to its former prominence, right? I was never in the Uptown, but I used to go to the Southtown all the time when I was a kid. Now, that's been long gone for God knows how many years. But that was like the sister theater on the South Side.
Uh-huh.
It was at 63rd and Wallace, basically.
The places are massive, too.
They were, I mean, I remember the thing being incredible when I was, you know, 10 years old, for God's sake. Big, huge aquariums, big monster staircases like you'd find in a Civic Opera House or someplace. And But that, you know, the neighborhood changed badly, and then all of a sudden the thing came down. First, it was a discount store for a while, which is disgusting. But anyway, guess how the guy says, well, how much is it going to cost to fix the place up? Guess what the guy said?
I couldn't even fathom.
I would have said at my top end would have been, I don't know, 20, 30 mil maybe. 160.
Oh, my. How are you going to recoup that?
Oh, that's all. I don't know what you're going to do with there, but for that, I don't know. You better hold a Democratic convention there.
I mean, really, on a cash flow basis, how are you going to recoup that?
Well, what I,
you know, every time, let's just, you know, what do you think the profit is off of, you know, like a mid-tier band playing a concert at the Uptown Theater?
I don't know if they're making it a theater, if it's a movie house or plays. I have no idea what they're trying to do, but I'm just saying,
hell, that's $160 million. That's a hell of a lot of butts and seats to watch a Star Wars movie.
One would think.
Yeah. So, you know, and
well, I'm saying the
I mean, that. Never mind.
Well, I'm trying to my theme here is people zero in on the gas pump and the other stuff when they talk about inflation.
Mm-hmm.
Get yourself away for that. Anticipate what might happen to you. Somebody rear ends your car. God help you if you got the cameras and the other stuff back there. We're talking 12 grand, 15 grand. When I had my old Suburban, I had to get the transmission redone. I'm going to say this was 6 years ago. 1500. I will say 32 to 35 today.
Yeah, no, we went to dinner last night at like a mid-level type place, and we don't drink, didn't have appetizers, and with the tip, the bill was $90.
And I bet
there are two of us, and you know, the place that we went, usually it was pretty busy. There were two other tables that had people at them. There was nobody there.
Everybody spent their wad this weekend. But you know what, Russell?
Yeah. Well, but where I'm going with this is, I continuously see this. You're seeing people spending less and less and less because they got less to spend.
Don't take this as personal.
Uh-huh.
If no drinks, no dessert, no appetizers, they don't want you back. They don't want you back.
Oh, I know they don't make any money off of us.
Yeah, they don't want you back.
But really the point was just how freaking expensive it was right off the bat. And there were only, you know, out of probably 30 tables, there were only people sitting at two other. There were more people that worked at the restaurant than were eating at the restaurant at dinner time last night.
I think they're having nights where if it's drizzling and it wasn't yesterday, it was a nice day, but especially,
yeah, it was beautiful. This place had patio.
Especially after big weekends where people spent a lot of money. I think the next Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, they might as well all close.
Oh yeah, they're usually fairly dead. So I do know that there's an anomaly on where we are in the calendar, but we see this more and more and more.
Well, we went
when we go out. It seems to be fewer people out, and everything seems to be a lot more expensive.
Well, the people, Audrey had people over working on her house last week, right? So it's late. It's like 7:30. We never go out when it's 7:30. And I go, Audrey, where do you want to go? She goes, let's just run over to Pepe's. There's a Pepe's there, and it's actually a really nice place, even though it's. Pepe sounds like a chain. They got a gorgeous bar, big TVs. You know, you go tell them what you want to watch, sports. And so we go there, and the guy, of course, we know the guy. And I said, what's going on? He goes, we haven't had anybody all week. And I go, what are you talking about? Well, because they got Taste of Homer Glen. Everybody's over there.
Yeah.
So they drag everybody away for a festival, and the people are paying the real estate taxes are getting it shoved up behind. This next week is a... Yeah, I got a break here. Next week is Taste of Chicago. What do you suppose the droppage in the average restaurant in the city is going to be?
Oh, I'm sure. I know for a fact because I used to own a restaurant in Memphis. The month of May is the big because it's too freaking hot in the summer to do the festivals. But Memphis in May, it's like there's something going on every weekend. And May was very difficult for us.
You know, anyway, S&P futures down 40, NASDAQ down 226. Mm-hmm. We've actually come back here. We come back from break. Russell's going to start explaining the market to us here. This is crazy stuff. We'll be right back. Stacks and Jacks.
What are you going to do with your old car? You can try selling it. You could junk it. Or you can donate it to Heritage for the Blind. Your car will be towed away for free, and your donation is tax deductible. Just call 1-800-639-8620. Heritage for the Blind accepts cars, vans, trucks, and boats. It doesn't matter if your vehicle runs or not. It'll be towed away for free, and you'll be supporting those that need help. Heritage for the Blind is a nonprofit organization that helps the visually impaired live fuller lives. Call right now to donate your car. And as a special thank you for calling, you'll receive a free 3-day vacation voucher to many exciting locations. Call Heritage for the Blind right now. Call 1-800-639-8620. Donating is easy, and your vehicle is towed away for free. Plus, you'll get a free vacation voucher. Call now, 1-800-639-8620. That's 1-800-639-8620.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell. We have Andrew on the board. SP futures down 40, NASDAQ futures down 225. We were down a lot more. This is after Trump declared the ceasefire over. Hopefully that will just be temporary. There does seem to be people shooting at people in the Strait. I don't know what that whole story is. I mean, it seems very unclear as it closes it open. Anyway, the Dow futures are down 429. They were down over more than that. But individual stocks at Goldman Sachs down 11. We've got Travelers down. For some reason yesterday, we're beating up on the chip stocks, but all the healthcare stocks were to the moon. I don't get the rotation here. How you don't like chips, but you're going to put it all in healthcare. But that's kind of what happened. I've got Nvidia down $1.92, trading $1.95. Tesla down $3.57, $3.99. Microsoft down another $4.70, $3.84. I thought that was running up last week or two, and now it's not. So there's been this, you know, diversity with inside the tech area, where the buyers and the sellers. Micron down another $33. Again, I can't emphasize this enough. I don't know what we can do with this information, but the thing ran up to the point where we all were saying, boy, it's kind of high. It's down from 1250 to 905. That's 350 points. $1.1 billion shares outstanding, so that's pushing $400 billion lost in market cap in the last 10 days, which is now 25% higher than the biggest company valuation was in 2010. So we're talking about money of a size that, let's not talk about gasoline at the gas station anymore. whatever, even though nobody likes to pay any more for gas, and I know I don't. Over in Asia, we've got Nikkei down 1,400 at over 2%, 66,819. We've got the Hang Seng is actually up. I'm not sure why that is. Actually, you know what? They didn't trade yesterday. I'm not sure why. No, they traded. It's 702, but Shanghai's down 19. Anyway, we're not sure what we got mixed over there. DAX down 461, it's almost 2%. FTSE down 111, 105. CAC round down 149, again, almost 2% there. As a way of review yesterday, S&P was down 33, NASDAQ down 302. So it was a bad day yesterday. So we did again today. That's kind of a lot. The buy the dippers aren't doing so hot here. And here's kind of a reason. Again, it's a question for Russell. 10 years now, 456. I've got the 30 year at 5.07. So, you know, the trap numbers used to be 5 and 4.5, and we're pretty much well over those. You know, we'll see how that. Carl thinks it's finally happening. You know, we'll see. It's finally happening like about 100 times in the last 10 years, but maybe this time it is for sure. Brent up 3.26, 77.42. West Texas up 3, 73.45. RBOB up to $3. Not a big spike in RBOB, so probably pushing high threes to four, depending on your tax situation. Gold. Kind of whack on the gold, down to 4,081. It had got down a little under 4,000 and bounced way back up to 4,300. Now it's going back down again. So we're down 245, 5,888. Foreign exchange, and this is another one we have to talk about. The yen, 162.46. 160s are panic number. They're way through that. However, the euro is 114, so the dollar is still strong there. It was strong everywhere. Crypto, down 1,600, 62,063. So it's given up half the Trump rally of yesterday when he said he loves Bitcoin. So, anyway, we've got that going for us. Andrew, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
All right, it is 7:42 here in Chicago, July 8th. Starting off with just a little bit of sports here, the Cubs won over Baltimore, 5-2, while the Sox lost to the Red Sox, 1-8, and the Diamondbacks lost to the Cardinals, 1-4. Over to Chicago weather, it is currently 74 degrees. We're going to have a high of 89 today. It's going to be pretty warm. We're going to have sunny skies and a bit of humidity coming into the afternoon and the evening. Over in Phoenix, they got even worse weather over there. They're currently at 92 degrees. They're going to have high about 114. It's dangerous heat levels today with sunny skies.
Find out how dangerous. Walk out on some asphalt in bare feet. You're right to the emergency room.
Yeah, if it's bad enough here in Chicago, I don't think it can be any better over there. But for Chicago traffic, thankfully, that's not looking too bad. Inbound Kennedy from Montrose is going to take you 17 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lake Cook is going to take you 31. Inbound Eisenhower from Wolf Road is going to take you 33 minutes. Inbound Dan Ryan from 95th is going to take you 25 minutes. And the inbound Stevenson from I-294 is going to take you 31 minutes. Back to you, Chief.
So, Russell, where do you want to start? Japan, debt, stock market, Micron losing, gaining and losing. Last month I had the margin debt. At a new record, it was up $80 billion in 1 month. Are we anywhere near close to a danger spot here? What about Bitcoin? I mean, it goes down.
Oh, gosh, yeah, we are. And you may not remember this, but back in the late 90s, there was a day where, like, I think Henry Blodgett, it may have still been at Oppenheimer at the time, but he upgraded Yahoo and put a $400 price target on it. Stock was like around 100, and it hit 400 the same day.
Wow.
That was the kind of crap that we experienced during market tops. So, you know, the action in Micron, the extreme volatility in both directions, that's typically the kind of stuff that we experience when it's just a precursor to market giving an awful lot back.
Russell, so I have
but I'm telling me, Microsoft is the canary in the coal mine here. They're the biggest. They're NVIDIA's biggest customer. They cannot maintain the trajectory that they are on and maintain and stay cash flow positive with all the spending that they're saying that they're going to do. And companies, the one earnings announcement every year that you can go to jail for is the annual announcement. Microsoft is on a June year end. So when they report their earnings in a couple of weeks, or maybe two or three, I think it may be like even the last week of July, but when they report their earnings, they're going to give us an indication as how they're doing financially. They're going to give us an indication as to are they going to be able to maintain the amount of spending that they're going to have to be able to maintain to stay in the AI race, and they can't. And any weakness around that is going to ripple through the rest of the tech market. It's going to ripple through the rest of the stock market. So, you know, if you've got to pick a catalyst, I think Microsoft's earnings and the way the stock's been behaving, and you even brought it up, during the break there, just the way that the stock's been behaving, it's not a positive canary in the coal mine. It's a canary that's gasping for air.
All right, two questions. When Microsoft made it to, 50-something, their revenue per share is roughly $43, so they got to like 11 or 12 times revenue, which is really expensive for a company that big. I mean, the Ciscos and Oracles of the world in 2001, when they all crashed, or late 2000, they made it to like 10.5 or 11, and they all crashed. Now Microsoft has come down a lot, to where it's down to maybe 9.5 times revenue, which is still pretty high, but it's a lot better than it was. But what do you, when you see a, I say all the time, Russell, and I know I'm right, but I have no idea how to quantify how much I'm right. I've always said that if a stock is at 200, like you just said, goes to 400 and comes back to 200, most people think, okay, no harm, no foul. Everybody who owned it just saw it go up. It was a paper profit anyway, and now they don't have it anymore. I've always maintained that when a stock flies up and flies back down, more money's lost on the way down than is made on the way up, because there's always margin debt. There's debt. There's stuff that is taken out to buy another stock. I mean, PTI, we have customers with margin debt, but a lot of times it's small amounts. Somebody takes it out for whatever. But we don't really have the group that says, buy me 1,000 shares of Micron at $1,000 instead of sending you whatever. 100 shares at $1,000 would be 100 grand. I'm going to send you 50 grand. We're really not in that business. We could do that, but that's not. Those people don't find us. You know, they go somewhere else. But by and large, if there's any margin here and you come flying back down, it's not like the world is the same as when Microsoft was 900 before it went to 1250 and back down. But I can't quantify that. Can you, first of all, do you agree with me? And secondly, how much more do you think is lost? I mean, I have no idea. If somebody asked me, well, how much?
How much more is lost on the way down and
than made on the way up? But,
I think it's a different class of investor that gets the loss on the way down, and unfortunately it's kind of the, you know, you don't want to be the last one to a party. It's the people that are the last ones to the party.
Well, but you're going to get,
it becomes much more of a retail type thing than a professional type.
But what we have people that have, and again, we're the world's most conservative firm. Well, our clients are the most conservative firm. They find us, yeah. Right? But we'll have somebody who has, you know, 800,000 in stock and never has had a, you know, don't call Dan up and say, you know, hey, we're putting in a $40,000 kitchen addition. We'll take the loan from you guys at, you know, 5% rather than a credit card or something, or whatever, uh-huh. Whatever it is. We have that happening. We never see anybody say, "Well, give me every nickel you can." I mean, but by and large, anybody. I mean, well, Nancy talks about, she had a client that got a, this is mortgage stuff, went out and got a second mortgage on a house and bought Bitcoin at like 80. You know, I mean,
yeah, but don't do things like that.
I mean, but there's you don't even really know where the leverage is. That's my, right. One of my questions always to you. If Bitcoin were to collapse even more, they say there's margin loans on it, but I don't think if somebody wanted to buy, I know we can't, if somebody were to call us up and say, I want to buy 200 grand worth of Bitcoin, get me a $100,000 loan, I don't think we could do it. There's probably a couple of exchange products that maybe we could get them into, but now somehow or another, Coin and Robin and these other places do it. I don't know where they're getting that margin, but they're getting it from someplace. Now, what you're paying for it, or else, I mean, Kenny Pulcheri didn't he tell us once, Russell, that he, when Bitcoin first came out, they were giving him a percent a month or a percent and a half a month to lend somebody money so they would lend it out to somebody else at 3% for Bitcoin?
I don't remember. I mean, you've talked about that, but I don't remember that.
I mean, I mean, next time he's on, I'll ask him. But I mean, I'm saying it's not the normal kind of margin, and I don't know, right. if there's a 50-30 spread where the maintenance is 30 and the initial's 50. But it's stuff that you and I worry about. You know, I mean, you always, right. Worry about the Chinese stuff. How do we quantify that? I mean,
that's the one that's almost impossible to quantify. We know what we think they have. We know what we think they have and how they're positioned, but in reality, we've got absolutely no idea.
Well, my history of this is, there's way more here that I don't know, Russell. I know when the when the crap all collapsed in 2008, 2007 on the mortgages and stuff, and you kind of knew the people that were involved. It was Countrywide and these other people like that, and Goldman. All of a sudden, there was some mid-sized bank in Germany that went flat on its ass. I'm thinking, who are these guys? How did they make it into leveraged mortgage debt? And yet, somehow, people do, right?
Yeah, no, they were. I mean, that was the area that you really wanted to be involved in for a while. You know, I was at a hedge fund that was approached to sell credit default swaps. They're still a hedge fund because they decided not to.
Wow. Are they still doing those?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I teach them.
Oh, God. Well,
yeah, you can buy a credit default swap. You can buy a credit default swap on Microsoft's debt right now. There's an active market, and in fact, you can use the credit default swap pricing on companies. If you pay close enough attention to it, it tends to move before the stock starts to come under pressure.
All right.
And there's a strong relationship between the implied volatility of options on some stocks and what's going on in their credit default swap market.
Well, there should be.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's logical, but, you know, it's totally logical. But, yeah, we don't talk about personal trading too much, but, you know, half a decade or so ago, when Tesla had a bunch of convertible bonds outstanding, you could, if you saw price changes in the convertibles, you could get ahead of it with stock trading.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, you could totally key off of, start to see, the yield go up on their convertible bond in the morning, and in the afternoon, the stock was under pressure.
Well, let me,
but there's still, there are all kinds of credit default swaps out.
Well,
it's still a very active market.
What's also, I'm going to explain what I think the problem is with the pricing there, and then I'm also going to talk about the fact that it's not marked. The market is really the license to steal. If you, for instance, if the rate, let's pick Italy, if the rate on an Italian bond is 8% because they're kind of wobbly, I don't think it is anymore, but say it was, because it's kind of wobbly, and the rate here is 5 because we think the U.S. is, purer than Pharaoh's wife, which maybe we don't think anymore, but you can say, okay, I'm going to buy some insurance on the Italian bond versus, because these guys are more likely to go out of business, that's why I'm getting 8 versus 5. First of all, you better be sure you understand that part of it, right? The reason why you're getting more is because people think it's riskier. Now, if I go buy insurance on that, why isn't the price of insurance equal to the difference? I mean, why would somebody say, I'll charge you 1% for the difference when the market rate of the difference is 3? Isn't it being mispriced if it's anything less than 3? You grading my paper with a red pencil? What are you doing? Are you there?
What? I'm here. I was just, I got that question in class about, because I was talking about how, if you own a double A or you own a single A bond and you're getting a 5% yield and triple A is yielding 3% and you buy a credit default swap for only 1% on your single A bond from a triple A entity, you are now getting 4%. Basically making 4% with a AAA rating. You've improved yourself. That logically, it sounds like that shouldn't occur, and it really shouldn't. But if the one that's doing all of the insurance is diversifying themselves properly and kind of hedging themselves off properly as well, it is possible that you can improve your performance through, improve your relative performance through using credit default swaps.
Well, the part I have, and I always go for the scam part, which I probably shouldn't. That must be my south side stuff. And the guy who is right in my headlights is the guy who ran Merrill Lynch during this whole, before 2007. Because what happens here, I think, is if somebody comes to PTI or any place and buys Goldman Sachs for $1,000, and the next day it's 970, guess what? You're marked at 970. PTI doesn't mark the thing. There's a third-party group. We don't say, oh, by the way, it looks like 1,100 to us. I mean, we can't do that, nor would we want to. But I think what happened in 2007, and especially happened with this guy at Merrill Lynch, I don't forget the name, but if I did remember it, I wouldn't even say it. I think what happened there, Russell, is they charged the 1% like you're saying, when maybe it should have been 2, right? Or logically, maybe it should have been 2. Their own pricing model said it really should only be 0.5%. We just made 0.5%. And I think they were paying bonuses out on the 0.5% that they said they made based on their own marking their own crap to their own crap. And I think that guy walked away from Merrill Lynch with massive bonuses that turned out all blew up. I mean, if those things somehow could be marked to market and the bonuses weren't based on their interpretation of how much that was in profit, back in those days, you wouldn't have seen as much of it. Now, today, it's probably cleaner. But am I way off base here?
No, not at all. In fact, what you just described, well, it loops around to something that's misattributed to Warren Buffett. When we had the disaster in 2008, people dug back to his 2004 letter where he had said derivatives. He considered derivatives weapons of mass financial destruction or whatever. He was talking about over-the-counter derivatives, and if you read the whole letter after that quote, he even says, in fact, Charlie and I have come up with scenarios where both the buyer and the seller of these over-the-counter instruments could claim a profit at the end of each year.
That
was his concern about the derivative market right there, exactly what you just said. Had nothing to do with listed options or anything like that. It was the over-the-counter stuff.
Well, none of these guys ever gave their bonuses back.
And I'll tell you, I worked with a small hedge fund in Chicago it was before the financial crisis. Shortly after the financial crisis. And the guy's trading warrants on Japanese stocks, et cetera. And he figured out the P&L at the end of a quarter or something. And I was like, well, where are you getting that volatility number from? And he licks his finger and holds it up to the wind. And I basically started looking for another job the next day. I was like, this guy's just making up his numbers.
Well, he probably makes it up. And I don't think any of those people had to give their bonuses back. Okay, last question. This is where you got to put on, what was Johnny Carson? Karnak? You got to put the turban in? I'm looking at the debt to GDP. U.S., 1960, 53%. We still had some World War II debt, I believe. 1980, we got it down to 34. This is even after the oil embargo and all that crap. 2000, we're up to 57. Now we're 122. And, you know, we supposedly have been at peace, although we've had all these, I won't say small wars. If you get killed, it's not a small war.
We've been in a slow boil of peace.
Yeah. And so the question now is, 122 is one hell of a lot worse than 57. The debt per taxpayer, we're pushing now $356,000. Debt per citizens, 114. We had some of the worst labor numbers other than COVID I've ever seen on last Thursday. We got our participation rate down to 59, which is danger.
That's horrible.
Yeah. Now, last time I had this discussion was 3 weeks ago. I don't think it was with you. It might have been with Hal. The number was 121.9, and now it's 122.1 in terms of debt to GDP. You're not going to get anybody in Washington to say, boy, oh boy, we're getting pretty damn close to the cliff. We got to do something. The attitude, I think, is, everybody thought it was a problem at 119. Now it's 122. So what? A month from now or after the election, it'll be 126, and we'll worry about it then. Where's your number? Now, and world debt clocks, somehow the Japanese, and I think their stuff is really falling apart right now, they're at 250. So you could look at it and say we could become a zombie country and still be 250. Where's your if you had to pick a number where you just sit there and go, it's time to panic, I think we're close. I mean,
we're really close. But yet, here's the problem with where we are leverage-wise right now is, you know, I wouldn't have an issue with it if everything was just freaking awesome with the economy. You know, but... And my big fear is that there's some sort of belief that, you know, the internet kind of created a wonderful wonderful period for us in the 90s. We even had a balanced budget 1 year. Maybe there's this weird belief that the next leg of technology through AI is going to solve all of this for us. And I hope that's not that's not what some of the people are thinking.
Well, kind of last.
Or they're just I worked with a guy who years ago he was like an office manager at a fund, and before that he had actually he was supposed to manage a boys' home for the Catholic Charities was running. And whenever he would go and to the priest that was in charge of the place, he'd say, you know, we need more money for this. We need more money for that. And the priest would just said, you know, we'll just keep doing what we're doing and God will provide. Well, God never provided. And they went out of business.
Well, yeah.
I'm very concerned that They asked, and I try not to pick directly on any on.
Oh, who was the guy? Was it Allah, Buddha, the other guy? How many? Which guy?
I'm not going to get into that. but you know, years ago when AOC proposed the Green New Deal, yeah. And they said, "Well, how are you going to pay for it?" She said, "Well, the Federal Reserve will provide the money to pay for it."
Which they have been, by the way. Well, they have been.
Yeah, but she just said, you know, we'll be able to, you know, the Federal Reserve will be able to create some more money and create loan incentives, blah, blah.
Well, I'm appalled at what...
She didn't have a way to pay for it, is really what I'm coming down to. And I think the economic reality of just about everything that comes out of Washington, D.C. is just completely skewed right now.
I'm appalled that she said that, but I'm proud of her that she actually understands that's where it's coming from.
Yeah, at least
she's figured that out.
The Federal Reserve will just give me the money.
Well,
so I want to do this.
Well, where do you think everybody else in Washington thinks the same thing?
I think they know they're a little bit more grounded that they realize that.
Well, they're not dumb enough to say it.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what I was just about to say. Is they're not going to fully admit it.
Well, last quick question, and I guess it's a little bit political, but when it comes to this person's a socialist, this person's a communist, all this kind of stuff. And it's kind of crazy. But if we're talking about this deficit, and Larissa's been our star at pretty much describing the K-shaped. If the we're pushing a point where, you know, 90% of the wealth is in 10% of the people, and you want to raise taxes, it's sort of like robbing a bank. I mean, I'm surely not in the status of any of those guys, but the point being is, if we're looking to raise more money, you're not going to get it out of the guy making 40 grand a year. You got to get it where it is, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want that to happen. Obviously, neither do you, neither does any listener. But I mean, is it easier to get $1 billion out of Musk or to get $1 billion off the people on an Indian reservation? I mean, what are we talking about?
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of easier places to get $1 billion than from Mr. Musk. And I haven't had a chance to talk to her about it yet, but the K-shaped economy is now being cited as a potential issue in China.
God.
But here's the great part about that is basically anybody that does well in China is a member of the Communist Party. Only 7% of their population is a member of the Communist Party. So if 7% is on the top part of the K and 93% is on the bottom part of the K, and the bottom part of the K is going in the dumper, you're going to have a real social problem.
we're not far from that.
I know. Well, we're not far from that, but I think the big difference is how obvious the delineation is there.
Yeah. Well, they don't have. If it wasn't for,
and it's impossible. I mean, you know, if I'm too old for this now, but if we backtrack 30 years, if I've got some really good business idea, I have the ability to try and pursue that in the United States. I wouldn't be able to do that there.
No, I agree. Hey, we're way over, bud. And I could talk forever. Let's talk about. Hopefully, Larissa will be back next week. Let's talk more about that K-shape because it's kind of getting scary, and you wonder.
It is
a lot
the bottom part of the K is too big. It's going to swallow the top part.
And if you can pile hell into the same conversation, we wouldn't in this not at the same time. But the idea of the banking laws and the difference in who can borrow what and where, I think what you just said about you can start a business here is harder than it kind of ever was because of you're starting it on your credit card 20%. Everybody else is the bigger guys are getting, you know, a chunk from government or a state or something. It's pretty tough to do that. SP Futures down 44 and NASDAQ Futures down 228. Again, this is better than when we came in, so maybe we'll rally a little more here. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.